Okay, so I might be the only engineer speaking today, so bear with me. And since this is a 25-year talk, we're going to give the condensed version. So since the beginning, our efforts at Kansas State University, see, we're not going to be growing these fruits and vegetables and high-value crops, so we're trying to develop the technology for our region, protect water quality, and to enhance water conservation. And so why, or how could that even be practical in our area? And so we have a system that we've been operating since 1989 without replacement. And this graph here shows the flow rates over that 25-year period. And if you looked over on the far side over here, that data is from last week. So after 25 years, 23 of our 23 research plots are within plus or minus 5% of where they were the first season. And the one that's outside that range is only about 6% difference. So if we look at the corn yields from that study, now obviously we had different studies going on. So what I did was I took the average of the highest yielding drip irrigation plots in that. And over that 25-year period, we have an average yield of 14.5 megagrams per hectare. And I don't think you can see any pattern that they're actually declining. So is it practical? Well, I'm not going to give you the answer here on this slide, but we do have some software on our website. Just Google SDI and the Great Plains, and you can decide for yourself. So now let's move on. Let's move on to areas that might be of interest to the soil physics community. And these are the ones that I come up with. There's probably some more based on Dr. Ben Asher's talk. I realize I should have had a couple more in there. But design issues, they're listed there, emitter discharge, drip line spacing, orientation of the drip lines, emitter spacing and depth, and then some special issues that come up to us in the Great Plains and obviously elsewhere in the world also. Germination, nutrient management, nutrient availability, and the surfacing or chimney effect is kind of a common terminology. So obviously some of those interact and strongly interact, and not all of them are going to be fully explored here. And then some of them, to a certain extent, become moot because of practical constraints of how you design the system or the type of crop production you're using. So I'll try to highlight some of those that I think maybe kind of fall by the wayside. So there's a wide range of emitter discharge available from the manufacturers, but you know, farmers come to me and say, well, what kind of emitters discharge should I look at? And you know, they're thinking about it in terms of providing the water, but the evaporation needs of the crop, they really have very little influence at the typical spacings and discharge rates that are available. It's because they're greatly in excess of ETC. However, there is some physical limitations to how much you could reduce the emitter discharge because the smaller smaller passages are easier clogged. But in our region, since we're trying to develop this for low-value crops, we want to make our systems as cheap as possible. So a lower emitter discharge in combination with a greater emitter spacing is economically attractive to our producers. And it has worked quite well on our deep, medium-textured soils. In contrast, when the emitter discharge is greater than the saturated hydraulic conductivity, and obviously there's people here in the audience that know this topic better than I, there can be back pressure on the emitter, which can cause irrigation uniformity problems that can have both a problem in the irrigation uniformity and also in the soil water redistribution. So when this back pressure occurs, oftentimes we call that the chimney effect or surfacing. And when this water is trying to find a path of least resistance, oftentimes that's towards the soil surface. And then that leads to increased soil water evaporation and then possibly some irrigation runoff. Here's a slide showing some of that surfacing in alfalfa fields in a canola field in California. That little, there in the very center of the photo, it's called a caldera. And when that forms, that water has come to the surface as free water. And even though you may have some tillage to try to disrupt that, that pattern is already developed, and it's very difficult to get rid of. So let's move on to drip line spacing. So that's usually set by the cultural practices in a given region, and also by the planting and harvesting operation. As a general rule, the drip line spacing is the multiple of the crop row spacing, where the emitter spacing is usually related to the plant spacing along the row. So for in our area, we look at 0.75 meter crop rows, and then we would look at drip lines spaced every 1.5 meters. However, there is some interest in Texas because of some of the germination problems about actually putting one drip line for every crop row. However, once again, that the economics comes into play. So what happens when you have these wider drip line spacings, obviously, is you can have crop failure. You're just not providing enough water. So let's talk a little bit about orientation. And though I would almost always recommend that you have your drip lines parallel to the drip line, your crop rows parallel to the drip lines, that's not always followed in our region. And that's because some people like to be able to capture some of that rainfall that occurs during the summer months, and they would actually plant they would put their drip lines in according to where their water source is, and that keeps it cheap. You know, so if they have their water source at the edge of the field, they would like to start from that location. But perhaps their land slope, maybe it was a fur irrigated field, and maybe their land slope works the other way. So they like to put those drip lines perpendicular. So that occurs some. The emitter spacing, as I said earlier, I mean, that's one way that you can, use more expensive emitters. You can have longer lengths of run, and that's going to decrease your design cost some. However, you have to balance that against whether you're actually providing adequate water in the ridge zone. And so we conducted a study that ran for 3 years looking at drip lines emitter spacings ranging from 0.3 to 1.2 meters. And our initial thoughts was the 0.3 and the 0.6, we knew they worked. We thought 0.9 might be okay, but we thought obviously 1.2 meters would be too far apart. And so this is just showing in this graph is showing the 0.3 meter emitter spacing. And we see that there's increased movement of water along the drip line as compared to perpendicular to the drip line. And this is initially after the initial installation. We did the same thing 1 year after installation, and we were still seeing that increased water movement along the drip line. This is when we went to the far extreme, and so now we're looking at distance from the emitter. The emitter spacing is 1.2 meters, and once again we see more water movement parallel to the drip line as compared to perpendicular to the drip line. So we've also looked at yields, and we've not seen any differences in corn yields or growth for these different spacings also. So this has actually come up in some questions that's recently been posed to me. A micro-irrigation designer said, well, I see your results from this 1.2 meters, and I'd like to put in a system like that. However, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it, but he indicated that he could see design cost savings about 20% by using that wider emitter spacing. So obviously, this still is a question that could perhaps be answered by the soil physicist for the different soil types. We've done some work with depths. We've looked at depths from 20 centimeters up to 60 centimeters, and we really haven't seen a whole lot of difference. Generally, the depth is chosen by local experiences, and although there is some models that exist, they often are not used, and so that may be some efforts that need to be continued to be worked on. For alfalfa, they're often put in at deeper depths. We have some in at 50 centimeters, and we tend to have less rodent problem when we put it in at that depth. However, if you need it for germination for some of the crops, some of the farmers are beginning to put their systems in shallower than that. For the lower value crops, generally these systems are putting in at 30 to 45 centimeter depth range. And most of these systems have fairly expensive root systems, and we really haven't seen any differences in the crop performance with depth. However, that is when there is no issue of germination. Now, when germination is concerned, then you might want to put it in the systems in shallower. And that's just saying that we have less problems with the rodents at the deeper depths. So let's move on to nutrient management. In an early study that we had, we found that nitrogen redistributed differently in the soil than when it was surface applied, as you might expect. And what we actually saw that was the nitrogen with SDI was building up to deeper in the deeper depths. And so that that led us to a study to see if the nitrogen levels could be lowered. And as a result, we developed a best management practice in the mid-90s that stated that we could put on about 180 pounds of nitrogen per hectare. And that's in addition to about 30 kilograms of nitrogen that was applied with the planting operation. Okay. So our yield and our nitrogen all plateaued at about yield, nitrogen uptake, and water productivity all plateaued at about the same area. And after 4 years of continuous application, the soil nitrogen was increasing when we were above that 180 kilogram per kilograms of nitrogen per hectare fertigation rate. And so this emphasized that we could develop a best management practice that would be both environmentally sound and efficient in nutrient and water use. So, but there is a caveat, obviously. When you start managing both water and nitrogen to the high level, there can be less margin of error. And I'm just going to show you what can happen. This is some corn that's irrigated with subsurface drip irrigation. I can assure you there's plenty of nitrogen there in the soil, but that corn is still experiencing nitrogen stress. And so what's happened is the nitrogen is positionally unavailable because this nitrogen in this particular study was applied on the surface. So we have a dry soil surface, and we have the water from below where you can have this positional unavailability. So I want to close with, you can have the best technology, or you can have the best management, but if you don't have them working together, you really can't optimize it. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions if there's anything time left. So the question was, what's been the adoption of drip irrigation in the Great Plains? The greatest adoption is actually occurring in Texas, and it's for cotton production. And there's a number of reasons that we probably can't get into all of them here. We're in the Great Plains, a lot of it's already been converted to center pivots. And so that's going to be slow movement away from center pivots because they're fairly efficient. However, the ones in general, the ones that have adopted subsurface drip, most of them seem to be increasing their acreages over time.